It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in this week for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up, we'll be talking with Scott Bauer of the Associated Press about yesterday's federal injunction of Wisconsin's new abortion law. But first, Ramadan began at sundown last night.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic calendar. It's the month during which Muslims believe the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad. And to mark it, Muslims around the world fast from sunup to sundown. And here with us to talk about the meaning of Ramadan and how it's observed here in the U.S. is Asra Nomani. Asra was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal for 15 years and is the author of Standing Alone in Mecca. Asra, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much.
So how would you describe the meaning of Ramadan in Islam?
Well, I think it's basically like a spiritual boot camp. You know, for 30 days, you refrain from food and drink, sex, and other ideas like gambling or gossiping from basically before sunup to sundown. One of my cousins was telling me she ends up ending the month with a spiritual high.
So you describe it as spiritual boot camp. Is the idea to cleanse yourself, to live with less?
It really is to, you know, try to simplify your life, to really go back to the essential core of your ruh. It's a word that means your soul, your spirit. And, you know, of course, everybody needs to eat and drink to be alive. And so, you know, we have food then before sunup and after sundown. But it's to sort of show yourself sacrifice and to sort of and to see what it is that is essential in life and what it is that is essential in your life.
How does it feel to go through that month? Do you start out with one mentality and emerge with another?
Well, I think, you know, like all things, you never really know what's going to happen. You get tested both physically because you feel the kind of irritations that happen with food deprivation or dehydration. I mean, there's physiological things that happen within a person, and you really have to figure out how to calm yourself, how to be tempered, because really during this month, you're supposed to be the best of what you can be. You're supposed to rise to the highest standards of life. And, you know, the month is marked in the Muslim calendar as the month in which the Prophet Muhammad received the revelations for the Quran. And so the idea is that this is a month in which you, too, are connected to this higher experience that's beyond the worldly existence.
Now, you've observed Ramadan in the United States and other places in the world. What is it like? How does it compare?
Well, you know, in the U.S., it's really your private experience and your family experience. In other parts of the world where there are Muslim majority countries, it's a societal experience. I had a lot of fun, and I have had a lot of fun practicing it in the U.S. because you involve your friends. When I worked at the Wall Street Journal, one year the sun would set right around deadline, unfortunately after deadline. And so I would be taxed, you know, finishing my stories and filing them. And then the sun would go down. And then what I would do is order samosas, nice dish, you know, from my native India, mm-hmm. and have what I called a break fast club. And so all my friends who weren't practicing the fast enjoyed it because they got, you know, this nice treat. And I had the joy of their company.
Oh, that sounds like a nice way to observe. And if you were observing it in India, what would it have been like? You said it was more societal. What would that have felt like?
Well, in India or in Pakistan, you know, where in India Muslims are still a minority, and in Pakistan, where it's a majority country, what you have is, you know, the entire city and the hubbub of the country really, you know, kind of chilling out during the day, and then at sun up, you know, you see this buzz in everybody's homes because everybody's having their meals right before you see the sliver of the light. And then at sundown, you always know everybody's going to be home, or they might be at these little tea shops and other places to break their fast. I really enjoyed it. In Pakistan, they have Pizza Hut, so I would go for my my early morning meal sometimes at the Pizza Hut.
At Pizza Hut?
Yeah, exactly. So that was like really unique experience. And then other times, you know, they're bowling alleys. So they, you know, the entire industry of consumers gets involved. And so you have your breakfast meal at the Pizza Hut, and you go bowling out at the Area 51 bowling alley down the road.
That is different.
Yeah.
So you have a sweet memory, don't you, of your father waking you up for Ramadan?
All through my childhood, you know, I'm 48 now. And so when I was a kid, Bruce Jenner, right, before the nose job was on, on the Wheaties box. I was a runner, and I would always have my Wheaties every morning for breakfast. And what my dad would do then is come and wake me up. And we would both sit there with our bowls of Wheaties, you know, and Bruce Jenner, and have this quiet moment, because it's such a really special time, you know, before the sun has come up for any early risers.
It is.
Yeah. You know, the birds are just waking up, and there's just a stillness in the air. And you know, I just love that. And it's like one of my fondest memories from my childhood.
And you thought a lot about going deeper into Ramadan. How have you deepened your observance over the years?
Well, you know, in the Ramadan of 2003, it was the eve of Ramadan when in my hometown in Morgantown, West Virginia, we were opening up a new mosque. And I went to the mosque excited with the rest of the community to start the month the next day. And that night, one of the elders stood at the front door and he said, "Asra, take the back door," because like so many mosques in this country, you know, 2 out of 3 mosques, women are sitting in a segregated area. In our mosque in Morgantown, we had to go through a back door. And I stood there and I thought, wow, this is not right. You know, in this country where I'd grown up with separate is not equal. And I walked through the front door, and that entire month I was in the mosque while we did these special night prayers called Taraweeh prayers. And what we usually do is read the Quran. What I read during that month was scholarly works on reinterpreting the Quran from a feminist perspective. And it was really during that month that I came to understand feminist principles in Islam and how we were denying them in our communities too often. And I realized also that, you know, inside each of one of ourselves, like we really, the deepest struggle that we could have, our deepest jihad, as we call it, is to be better people, to be better communities, and to serve those who are in need. And I realized that, you know, a lot of these external practices that we do, from fasting to other rituals, are sometimes done without the pursuit of these higher principles. And so my deeper soul searching that began that Ramadan and continues to today is that it's not just about, you know, abstaining from food and water during the day. It's about rising to your higher self. And to me, it's not you know, the deepest benefit that we could get from this month is to try to figure out how to be better citizens of this world. And so we actually are having conversations that would be considered, you know, complete heresy in many communities, many conservative Orthodox communities, where people are saying, you know what, it's not as important to fast as it is to really just be a good citizen and to learn to do that every day of our lives so that we can make this world a better place.
Well, Asra, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on Ramadan with us. Appreciate you being here.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Asra Nomani, a journalist and author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam.
Coming up next, we'll check the headlines, and then we'll hear from AP reporter Scott Bauer on the recent federal injunction of Wisconsin's new abortion law. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Last Friday, Governor Scott Walker signed a controversial abortion bill into law. The law requires women to receive an ultrasound before having an abortion, and it also requires that doctors who perform abortions have hospital admitting privileges.
But yesterday, federal judge William Conley put a freeze on the part of the law requiring doctors to have hospital admitting privileges. And here with us to discuss the injunction and the law is Scott Bauer, the Associated Press reporter based in Wisconsin. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with a little bit of background on the law itself. This type of legislation is something that, as I understand it, is happening around the country. I know there's legislation going on in Texas, North Dakota, Ohio, and Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. It's an idea that's being introduced around the country, and here in Wisconsin it came up very quickly. The bill was introduced in early June. It passed the legislature in 9 days. And the governor signed it on Friday, the day after the 4th of July holiday, and with little fanfare, just announcing it in a press release that went out Friday afternoon.
And the legislation in Wisconsin, let's talk about specifically what it was would have done, because the legislation around the country is similar in some regards in terms of restricting access. But in Wisconsin, what were we talking about?
There are two main parts of it. The first part requires any woman seeking an abortion to first have an ultrasound performed and to have the results of that ultrasound made available to her to see. The second requirement was that doctors performing abortions must have hospital admitting privileges within 30 miles of the clinic where they perform the abortion. So the argument among supporters was that would provide a higher level of care, that doctors ought to have admitting privileges and they could follow their patient, if need be, to the hospital. But those who challenged the law pointed out a number of problems with that, one of which was, a number of doctors don't have hospital admitting privileges because they don't admit very many patients. And so the real goal, they argued, was to limit the number of doctors who could perform abortions in the state.
Yeah, and as I understand the idea behind admitting privileges, it's not as easy as a physician just going to a hospital, showing them their diploma or qualifications, and then getting them. I mean, there's a process there. And some quotas, apparently, that they've got to meet in terms of admitting a certain number of patients and so forth.
Yeah, the attorney, one of the attorneys who brought the case, Lester Pines, said after the hearing yesterday that really he believed the intent was to put these doctors in the catch-22, and that if they do good work, they don't admit very many women to the hospital because they aren't, that extra care is not needed. But in order to get admitting privileges to hospitals, you have to admit a certain number of patients. So the way Pines presented the argument, it was that these doctors would almost be put in an impossible situation.
So which groups filed the lawsuit and challenged this?
Well, the lawsuit was filed by Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin and also by Affiliated Medical Services, which runs a clinic in Milwaukee. And Affiliated had said that under the law, its clinic would have to close because its doctors do not have the admitting privileges. And Planned Parenthood had said that its clinic in Appleton would have to close for the same reason. And if that indeed had happened, that would leave the state with, it would go from 4 to 2 clinics where abortions could be performed, one clinic in Madison and one in Milwaukee.
And we should clarify here, the judge ruled on an injunction on just a portion of this legislation?
Yeah, that's correct. The lawsuit that was brought did not challenge the ultrasound requirement. So that provision of the law went into effect on Monday and remains in effect. The only portion that was challenged and that was temporarily put on hold is the admitting privileges requirement. So there's a hearing on July 17th where they will discuss the request for a preliminary injunction. What happened yesterday was a temporary restraining order.
All right. So, and the judge's decision, you can find it on a number of news sites right now. It's fairly lengthy, but from your reading of it, Scott Bauer, what were some of the key points?
Well, it was interesting that the judge ruled as quickly as he did, because the hearing yesterday kind of came together very quickly in that he had set the July 17th date for the actual hearing on the temporary restraining order preliminary injunction request, and this was thrown together yesterday afternoon. Initially, it was to be a phone conference call, and then it was in court. And the attorneys for Planned Parenthood had requested quick action because they had a number of women who had appointments scheduled for this week that would have to be canceled. The judge, the hearing ended around 3 o'clock, and the judge wouldn't commit to offering anything immediately other than he said he would rule by Tuesday morning. Well, at 6 o'clock, he put out an 18-page order that was pretty detailed in terms of his analysis of the law and some of the problems he saw with the constitutionality of this admitting privileges requirement. So it was pretty clear that he had done some work ahead of time and was leaning towards something before the hearing actually came out. And the ruling, you know, is pretty clear in saying that the state failed so far to show that there's any benefit to the maternal health of the mother in requiring that these doctors have admitting privileges. That was the issue the judge really focused on in the hearing and wanted the attorneys to speak to, was how does this requirement benefit the health of the mother.
And so where does the state go from here?
Well, the state, in their defense, was arguing that they had very little time to prepare to present arguments on Monday. The assistant attorney general who was there said that he intends to call expert witnesses who will testify to the fact that it is to the benefit of the health of the mother that the doctors have hospital admitting privileges. Certainly they'll try to put evidence up to that fact to build that record. And the other side is also saying they're prepared to put up their own experts to say just the opposite.
And I wanted to ask a little bit about that reaction as you described the process that happened yesterday with Judge Conley. It happened in a hurry, but it sounds like both sides were ready and both sides are responding already.
Yeah, I mean, it's a situation, and the judge commented on it, that even though this is all happening very quickly with the bill signed on Friday, the hearing on Monday, the temporary restraining order issued Monday night, that both sides were very clear in what was going to happen. The opponents of the law said they were going to challenge it in court immediately, which they did. Supporters of the law, Wisconsin Right to Life, and groups of from that side of the issue were very clear in saying they expected legal challenges and they expect to prevail ultimately. So, and even the attorneys yesterday, you know, this restraining order is good for 9 or 10 days until that hearing on the 17th. And even then, everyone seems to agree that this is ultimately going to go to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
And I'm wondering, when you say that, other legislators, legislatures around the country watching this process, do you think?
I'm sure there are, as you mentioned, given the number of other laws that are very similar and working their way through the process. I haven't taken a close look at all of those, but I would imagine at some point you may see some of these consolidated, or you may see something ultimately going through the, you know, the federal appeals court process and maybe to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So what happens then to the remainder of the legislation, the ultrasound portion of that? That simply remains in effect, or is there a possibility that that could be challenged as well?
That remains in effect. Of course, there's always a possibility that could be challenged as well. There's nothing to date that's been filed on that, but again, the law's only been in effect for a couple days, so it's possible you could see a legal challenge of that as well.
So looking ahead to, what is it, July 17th is the hearing?
That's the hearing, and it's possible that you'll see almost like a little mini-trial. As of last night, the attorneys weren't sure yet if witnesses would actually be called, but it seemed highly possible that would happen. If not, you would certainly have depositions submitted as part of the record. And it will be a little more lengthy of a laying out of the evidence, and certainly the state will have, I think, more to offer than they did yesterday to defend the law. And we'll see. I mean, the judge was pretty clear where he was headed in the and the order he put out yesterday. So I think the state will certainly have the burden to try to convince him otherwise.
So keep our eyes open for July 17th.
That's right.
All right, Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime.
We've been talking with Scott Bauer, a reporter for the Associated Press here in Wisconsin.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll discuss how the produce we eat today has fewer nutrients than that same produce did in the past.
And coming up tomorrow, too, we're also going to be speaking with Chris Chloe. He is arguably the most famous punter in the NFL. We'll be talking with him about sports, online activism, and what it's like to embrace your inner nerd.
And we'll hear about an organization that's trying to increase the level of diversity in children's books.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Rob Ferret this week.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Now, I'm a fan of a supper club, and having spent most of my life here in Wisconsin, that's true of me, but I'm not an aficionado like you are, Gene.
Ah, yes, that is so true. You know, I haven't been to all of the supper clubs in Wisconsin, but I've lived here a long time, and I've been to a bunch of them. In fact, here's a little bit of my personal history. People are looking at me. You know, I've got a personal history. I started my work career working as a dishwasher at the 10 Mile House.
Really?
Which I think is a great name for a supper club.
Where is the 10 Mile House?
It's gone now. It's just a distant memory now, like so many supper clubs. But the fact is, I still love supper clubs, and I still go to them whenever I can. Whenever I'm in a town with one, you try to make that effort to go see it. So when I saw this book, the supper club book that we'd be talking about, A Celebration of a Midwest Tradition, you know, I just had to learn a lot more.
Well, we're curious about supper clubs. We're going to be talking about them in just a moment. And we want to hear from you about what makes for a great supper club. They're known for their old fashions, mm-hmm. that relish tray that I love. And we're curious about what's your favorite supper club and what is the most delectable thing that you ate at your favorite supper club. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org.
Now, the author of the Supper Club book is Dave Hoekstra. He is a staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, and we're going to take a chance. We've been having some technical challenges and see if Dave is with us yet. Dave, are you there?
I'm here.
Perfect. It's good to have you along, and it's a great topic to be talking about and something to plan for as we head towards Friday. Even though it's Tuesday, we're already looking ahead to the weekend. And I have to ask you, you know, as somebody who writes for a living, you've got your choice of subjects of things to write about. Why did you pick supper clubs?
They came out of, I think, just I've been doing travel columns for the Sun-Times. I worked at the Chicago Sun-Times. I've been doing those for 18, 19 years, and I was just enchanted by the quick escape of, you know, like getting out of Chicago and going to a completely different environment, different locale, you know. I tell people there was a little bit of my life I spent in Columbus, Ohio, and there was a thing, and actually they call it the Kiki Supper Club, and it's gone now, but it's a Polynesian Kiki bar, you know, with waterfalls and the live band, and it was all like a supper club motif, and it's the Polynesian spin. And I was like 6, 7 years old, and it was just larger than life, you know, and I never forgot that place. And that's how Supper Club for me is.
Yeah, I want to start out just by sort of defining Supper Club, and I imagine this is a question you get a lot. Because, you know, you've got food carts, you can go to a diner and have some food, you can go to a restaurant, but what is a Supper Club? How do you define it?
Well, it's fun. I mean, I had a little checklist, you know, and I'd play loose. You know, I just try to evoke different responses out of people. I mean, there was you know, typical things you guys know about, like the Friday night fish fry and the Saturday night prime rib. One of the working titles of the book was going to be Supper Clubs Have Linen Napkins, but in the 3 summers I spent researching the book, I found that's gotten kind of expensive for a lot of supper clubs. You know, a lake and woods view is something that, before I knew much about this, that was something I was very loyal to, and then that kind of changed as I did more research and stuff. Linear architecture, like the Del Bar in the Dells, which was designed by a student of Frank Lloyd Wright. I like the linear architecture, great neon, you know. Lazy Susans are going away, like 1 or 2 of the clubs still had Lazy Susans. So, you know, those things, veteran waitresses and staff, you know, stuff like that.
We're talking about the Supper Club book, A Celebration of a Midwest Tradition, with Dave Hoekstra. He is a staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times, a great book that takes a look at supper clubs, not just in Wisconsin, but in several states throughout the upper Midwest, including Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota. I think he might get into Ohio, too, a little bit. But we're going to be talking, of course, a lot about Wisconsin and taking your calls in a few minutes at 800-642-1234. That is our toll-free number. And don't forget, you can also email us with a comment, maybe about a favorite supper club that you know about, a place people ought to think about checking out, or maybe get some recommendations from our guest. Dave Hoekstra, one of the things I'd like to talk a little bit about, you said you had that checklist. And it's interesting because I think that a lot of people, once they start thinking about this, they've got their checklist too. So what are some of the things on your checklist? You talked about the architecture a little bit, the lake and the woods view. What else are we missing from your list?
Dark lighting, you know. I mean,
We're
just up in your area. We did a thing at Smokey's a couple of weeks ago. It started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Sure.
I thought it was 4 in the morning, you know, like dim lighting where you never really know what time of day it is. That's a great classic. Now, of course, what Wisconsin, I think, is best known for is the brandy old-fashioned, you know, and I didn't know much about that until I started. You know, there's a place in Beloit called the Butterfly Club, and they were telling me about the old-fashioned. You know, it's 5 minutes off the Illinois border, and you go to Rockford, and they don't know what the brandy old-fashioned is. You cross that Wisconsin border, and there's the brandy old-fashioned. I maybe had three in the 3 summers that I did the book and stuff, but I found how exclusive that was to Wisconsin. You know, I heard the story more than once. Is like you go to Las Vegas, and you order a brandy old-fashioned, and they'll know you're from Wisconsin.
Yeah, indeed. Now, where did you start with this? Because, you know, the supper clubs have been around for a while. There are a lot to choose from. So as you started your trek, was this like, I'm thinking of the Odyssey. Was this just this really long, epic journey for you?
It kind of wrote it, you know, it kind of, I know I'm not a food critic, so I knew it wasn't going to be a food book. And it's not a food book, and there's no recipes. We have an online site with a few recipes and stuff. But it was the stories that kind of drove the book. I mean, I just collected, you know what I think are 24, 25 really, really good stories of the people. The thing that, as I learned in the 3 years I worked on it, was that connects everything is sense of place. I mean, that's really, really important. These places all have rituals. They all have rich memories. There's a quote from an anthropologist I use in there from Wisconsin who talks about no place is a place until it is remembered. You know, and that's very rich in these places. That's the thing. Even the newer ones, I mean, they're quickly establishing that type of environment.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a little bit about that because most of the supper clubs featured in your book have been around for a while. Some of them, you know, date back to the 30s, 40s, and the 50s and so forth. But one of the supper clubs you featured is the Old Fashioned, which is in Madison right off the Capitol Square. And it's sort of a recreation of a supper club. So does a supper club have to be old, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, you know, I get that. I spent a lot of time in Madison, you know, and people have very strict definitions. You know, it's not in the country and not old and stuff. But, you know, they grew up around the White Stag. I think it's in Rhinelander, one of the owners, and they use that as a template. That's what's really, at the end of the day, that's what was really exciting about the book, are finding the younger people who are getting involved in supper clubs and putting their own twist on it and stuff. They're a lot more green over there at the old-fashioned than the traditional supper club. They go over to the farmer's market there at the state capitol, and they bring a little red wagon over and get their food. And one of the members is the president of the founder of the chapter of Slow Food there in Madison. So I think it's real exciting that we're jazzing it up, making maybe even a little healthier food, expanding on the menu and stuff. And I found that there's another one in downtown Detroit, you know. I mean, some of these places, I was probably in Detroit for a baseball game. And you go by this place, it's called Cliff Bell's, and it's in a really, really burned out corner of Detroit. And same thing's happening there. It's 30-year-old people who are bringing this place back to life. Actually, they're using the Green Mill here in Chicago as a template for live entertainment, which is a whole other thing about how these places used to have a lot of live entertainment. And I just think that's really thrilling that it's taking on a new twist with younger people.
Well, we've got lots to talk about and lots of callers who would like to join in. And we also have just a comment here, too, that, and this is for future reference, the lazy Susan determines if it's a supper club to me. So there you go.
There you go.
We're talking to Chicago Sun-Times staff writer Dave Hoekstra about his new book on supper clubs. And we're going to keep going after the break, but first we'd like to hear from you, too. So what is the best supper club, in your mind, in the Midwest? And why do you think it is that supper clubs are so special? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time, and we're picking up our discussion on supper clubs now with reporter Dave Hoekstra, and we're taking your calls about your favorite supper club in the Midwest. Which place is it that you keep going to? Which place is it that you've been meaning to go to? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or drop us an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Dave Hoekstra, we're going to get to calls in just a second. Before we do that, you know, one of the dangers when you write a book like this, I imagine, is that everybody thinks that you left someplace out.
Yeah, that's why we're starting a website. So our website's up.
So it's infinite that way, right?
Yeah, right. And well, you know, it's real interesting. We want the website to be interactive. I mean, the book's going to have a short shelf life and stuff, but what's interesting, even in the comments we've got, the book only came out June 1st, but food memories are just so rich, and people have, you know, you just talked about somebody, you know, talking about the Lazy Susan and stuff, and that's something that just drives people, and I find that in literature and in writing, it's just like food memories are so strong. So we want the website to have people share, food memories, talk about the clubs we miss, talk about places that have closed down, talk about places that are opening up, you know, so I'd like to at least continue to be some type of dialogue, at least on the web, when the book has run its course.
And you mentioned food, but in a lot of regards, it's more than food. You know, I'm thinking of Ed Sullivan's in Trempealeau, which is one of the places you went to. And if you would go there, you know, Ed and Sally knew you, you know, and you knew all about them, and it was like going to a friend's house almost.
Yeah, you know, it's this, in the course of doing the book, I was talking to Hugh Hefner for a story for the Sun-Times. He was on a bus tour of Chicago with his family and his future wife or whatever she is now. And I was telling him I was working on this book, and I said, you know, did the Playboy Club have anything to do with the Supper Club? Was the Supper Club an influence? Because, you know, the Playboy Club had good chefs and stuff, and he claimed that's exactly what was going on. He goes, you had a host or a hostess. You had, you know, entertainment. So many supper clubs used to have live entertainment. The dark lighting and the linear architecture I talked about. So there was always there was always somebody you knew behind the bar, always the owner, there was always a visible, you know, none of these places are corporate things. They're all family run operations. You know.
Well, let's check in with listeners, and we start with Tony, who joins us from Rhinelander. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you? You hungry?
Well, oh, I am now. I live in Rhinelander, and, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the White Stag because I drive past it every day on my way to work. I work in Eagle River, and it's, food is good, the staff is friendly, but for me, the biggest draw for the supper club is when I was growing up, my grandfather owned a supper club just outside of Osseo, south of Eau Claire, down by, it was called the Chief Inn, and the old-fashioned Friday night, boy, I tell you what, they would flow like water. It was fantastic. And it just, when you start talking about supper clubs, I can only think of my grandfather's supper club as I was growing up and how much fun we had there as kids.
Yeah, and I remember the Chief Inn, actually, Tony, and it was kind of in the middle of nowhere.
It was very much in the middle of all the farming community. You know, the winter time, the snowmobile trails went right past it, so everybody'd be out there on their sleds, and the summertime, the car parking lot was always full of cars.
All right. Well, Tony, thanks for...
Let me ask you, before you let him go, let me ask you a question about the White Stag.
Sure.
A photographer I worked on, this book, Paul Natkin, he's a rock and roll photographer here in Chicago, but he took about 30%, 40%. Anyway, his family had a home up there, and he would tell me, I wanted to get to the White Stag, but he would tell me, was that like a place for like gangsters like Capone and stuff like that? Would they hang out there? Because that was
one of
the
things... I don't know.
Go ahead.
No, that's all right. I'm sorry.
I mean, was there like bootlegging and gangsters and stuff up around there?
When you get up towards Manitouish Waters, you know, that's where Little Bohemia is, where Al Capone, where they had the big shootout with Al Capone, and Johnny Depp did his movie there a couple years ago.
Right.
You know, as far as the white stag, I don't really know. But they've got a big white concrete stag out in front still, just like they've had for as long as I can remember.
That's a great story, Tony. Thanks so much for sharing it. We've got a Facebook opinion, and Dave Hoekstra will need you to weigh in on this. This apparently is a rule. Hillary says on Facebook, must have pickled beets as part of the salad bar. How stern are you on
that?
Wow,
that's
pretty harsh.
That's a pretty deep groove, yeah. But I maybe saw that once, but yeah, that's good. I mean, I'm all for that. I don't eat many beets, but that's great. I like that.
Well, a good pickled beet will go a long way. Yeah. Let's head back to the phones right now. We've got a lot of callers who would like to join in, and let's go to Madison, and Julie is with us. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Tell us about your favorite supper club.
Oh, my favorite supper club is the Dorf House in Roxbury.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, actually, in the last 20 years, it's changed a lot. The owners actually just passed away earlier this year, and their kids have taken over and really made some really positive changes to it. And it is super busy every night, and you need a reservation. Excuse me, a reservation with at least a minimum of 8 people to, you know, make a reservation. Otherwise, they don't take reservations anymore because they're so busy.
Oh,
and
yes.
The fish is awesome.
The fish is, wild fish is, you know, it's a high bar. And in Wisconsin, you've got to meet that. Julie, thanks for calling.
Yep.
Let's go on to Steve, who joins us now from Wales. What you got for us, Steve?
Yeah, I've got a story about a supper club that unfortunately I don't know the name. But it was the most unique experience that I've had in supper club. And it's somewhere, I think, South Manitowoc, sort of close to the lake. I know it's between Door County and Milwaukee. And what happens is you walk in the front door, and the bar is to the right, and the eating area is to the left. And you sort of turn to the left thinking that you're going to be able to go in, but you can't. You're stopped. You have to go to the bar. You have to sit down, order a drink. You get a number. There's plenty of seating space as far as I can see in the eating area, but it's like, no, you have to experience this as a supper club with an old-fashioned at the bar first. And it turned out, you know, we were in a hurry. We were hungry at first. It was like, oh, man. But it turned out to be just a wonderful supper club and a wonderful sort of experience. And so as the before.
Oops, we apparently have lost Steve, but thanks for that, and I think we got the gist of it. And you know, Dave Hoekstra, it reminds me when we were hearing Steve talking, he was in kind of a hurry. They just wanted to get some food and be on their merry way. But there's something about the supper club experience. There's something about that place, that dark light, all of it, that kind of slows things down a little bit.
Right. I mean, that's right on. I mean, it's like a lot of these places, they would, you know, supper, that's a rural term, you know, and people would get there early, and they, I found this many, many times in my interviews, they'd get there around 4 or 5 o'clock, this was back in the day, and they'd have a couple drinks, you know, then they'd adjourn to the dining area and have supper with that great view we've been talking about, a nice leisurely supper, then they'd go back into that lounge area and hear some live music, have a few more drinks, you know. Two things happen. I mean, people are on a faster pace and the DUI laws and stuff, so people just don't devote that much time out, you know, like from 4 to like midnight at one place anymore, you know. So I found that a lot. Timmermans, there's one Timmermans over by Galena in Dubuque, Iowa. They even had like ballroom dancing and stuff. You can still go in there and you can see the dance floor. And Helen Timmerman, the owner, she used to come in a big gown and ballroom dance every night and stuff. And they might have like recorded music there, a band once in a while, but they still have the huge dance floor.
Molly joins us now, and Molly is in Baraboo. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am actually from California, and having lived in San Francisco and Los Angeles and worked in restaurants there, once I moved to Wisconsin about 10 years ago, my mother-in-law has a deep fondness for the supper club in her town, and I won't mention the name because I don't want to slander it.
Oh, no, Molly.
Fortunately, it's a pretty shabby establishment with, you know, the food is really nothing great. The service is nothing great. But listening to your show just now, I mean, I've just been puzzled with the nostalgia for supper clubs until you mentioned the Del Bar. And as far as I'm concerned, if the Del Bar ranks in supper clubs, then I'm a fan because I think it's one of the most elegant and sophisticated restaurants outside of Madison. So my horizons have been broadened.
Well, Molly, thanks so much for the call. The Del Bar, of course, is a great place in Wisconsin. Dells and Dave Hoekstra, a reminder that not all supper clubs are created equal. I mean, some, let's just say it, some are better than others.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And I think everyone in the book is a high quality one. You know, the other way there were like maybe there's 24 in the book. I probably visited 35. You know, so it was a selective process.
Let's take another call. Mike is with us from Milwaukee.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Great topic today.
Thanks.
Hey, I've been to a number of supper clubs. I'm calling from Milwaukee, but there's one up near Hayward, Wisconsin. It's called Club 77, mm-hmm. Located on Highway 77. Are you familiar with that one?
Oh, yes. Dave, are you familiar with that?
No, I know of Turks, but I don't know of Club 77. I just wrote
okay. For me, it's just the quintessential supper club. A, it's got club in the name. B, it's got the name of the county highway that's on the name. It's right there for you to figure out where it is. But one of the things about supper clubs, I think physically they have to have a separate bar or else it's not a supper club. There has to be that area where you can congregate before or after dinner. But 77 also has the full physical salad bar. They have a relish tray they bring to your table that actually has cheese fondue in it, which I think is unusual.
I think so too, but I like it. I like the concept.
Yeah, with every meal, you get free cheese fondue. I mean, what's not to like? And my other supper club favorite that goes at Club 77 and others are the combo meals you don't see anywhere else. It's like, I feel like ribs and walleye today. Well, it's at a supper club, you can get that. Or roasted chicken and, you know, a piece of beef. Usually they put those combos together for you.
That's a good point, yeah.
And, Mike, thanks so much. Go ahead, Mike. We'll give you a couple seconds here.
Oh, no, that was about it. Great topic. Thanks, guys.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Dave, we're going to have to let you go in about a minute and a half here. But before we do, you know, we're taking a lot of time looking back at supper clubs, and it's all feeling very nostalgic and, oh, gosh, isn't that great? But you say there is a pretty bright future ahead.
Yeah, and there's one in Minneapolis called the Red Stag, actually. It's almost like the same deal as what you got going on with the Old Fashioned. It's in a downtown location. It's kind of hip. The advertising community comes there. They have a big collection of, like, local beer cans and stuff, and the food is very good. One of the first lead restaurants in the state of Minnesota. So I think, you know, these the young entrepreneurs are really taking a spin on it. And the other thing that was kind of a perfect wave was the whole Mad Men thing, you know.
Because, oh, yeah.
A lot of places I went to, like there's one place, Jack's in Minneapolis, they have a Mad Men party at the supper club, you know. So there's that wave of that 60s nostalgia that kind of influences these places. So I think they're going to be alive and well, maybe in a little bit of a different form, but that's great.
So real quickly, one place that we really shouldn't miss.
Oh, I can't just pick.
Okay, two.
It's hard to pick one, but, you know, I love Madison. I'm not saying that because you guys are there, but there's three from Madison in the book, you know, and I wanted to do, now, I don't know if you guys call it the Tornado or the Tornado.
Yeah.
We were there just a couple weeks ago, and we ate there, and, you know, I love that place, and, again, the architecture of that place is so interesting. I'm talking about it. It's not even in the book, but, I mean, Madison is just a great destination for supper clubs. It really is.
All right. Well, Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dave Hoekstra, author of the Supper Club book. He's also a staff writer for the Chicago Sun-Times.
Coming up, we'll hear the latest from NPR and WPR, and then our installment on nostalgia, focusing on family cabins. I'm Veronica Rickert.